Yes, sir.
Red shirt status.
Thank you. I'll call the order of the House Committee on Health Care and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2505 and ask Representative Hannah to join us. Bring anybody with you want.
I come along. Thank you, Mr.
Blind
Chair.
Solo.
I appreciate you having me here today, colleagues. Thank you. Friday afternoon, and you're still hard at work. I appreciate that. For the record, I'm Bruce Hanna, State Representative out of House District 7. I come here to join you today and wish to testify in support of House Bill 2505, which I introduced as a way to help rein in growing costs of health care benefits for public employees, specifically those eligible to participate in the Public Employees Benefits Board, or PEB. First, the introduced version contained some errors, but introduction deadlines did not afford me the opportunity to fix the draft before introduction. Therefore, you have the Dash 1 amendments before you, which clarify certain provisions within the bill. It is these Dash 1 amendments that I would like you to consider and I will speak on today. The concept of the bill, though, is quite simple. It eliminates double coverage for employees receiving health insurance coverage through PEB. Insurance provided to employees through PEB is generous and covers that employee's family. This bill provides that if you are already covered under a PEB employee's health insurance, you are not eligible to receive your own full-fledged benefit package. Essentially, House Bill 2505 takes the current opt-out ability wherein a PEB employee wherein PEB eligible employees can elect not to receive coverage because they already have coverage and makes it mandatory for those already enrolled in a PEB plan through their spouse or partner. In exchange for opting out, the bill offers a $300 per month stipend to help offset any additional deductibles. There are currently, and this is critically important, there are currently 2,395 people double covered through the PEB system. If just half of those not receiving full benefits, which the costs are estimated at somewhere between $1,200 and $1,500 per month, and instead received the $300 per month stipend, that savings alone would be $27 million per biennium. Now, understand that these are rough figures. They do not include actuarial data that I am asking the department to provide, and we will get a more detailed cost analysis as we move forward. The Oregon Health Authority has raised some proposed changes to the Dash 1 amendments, which I would support, and I am working with them on. They include an effective date, clarification that an employee must opt out of medical and dental, and further clarification that the stipend only goes to the party not receiving benefits. It has been suggested that removing 1,200 individuals from the PEB rolls would cause our rates of insurance to rise by as much as $100 per month for the remaining PEB employees. I've asked for additional data. I can't imagine that to be the case. I actually work in, through our Bottlers Association, a very large health benefits organization, and I do not see the actuarial data to support that. Obviously, my intent here is to reduce health insurance costs to the state of Oregon. As a health insurance and health benefits provider myself, I'll be happy to work with the agency to help move this legislation forward. Regardless of some of the issues, I'm encouraged that the committee would hear House Bill 2505. The notation that many Oregonians get no health insurance coverage or have to pay thousands a year to purchase their own, yet at the same time we double the coverage for families in this system simply does not set well, especially as the cost of insurance packages provided by PEB are increasing at rates of nearly 20% per year. My intention here is not to remove health coverage from public employees. It is simply to ensure that the amount the state pays for that coverage matches the benefit they can receive so that we are not overpaying for the services and insurance. I greatly appreciate your time in hearing this bill, and I'd be glad to take a few questions if you have them. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Hanna, Representative Hanna. With the idea of double coverage, if let's say myself and my spouse are both state employees, will there be much of a reduction in the coverage of benefits, or it's just a duplication? What is that implication?
Co-chairs, Representative Doherty, the difference is likely to be in deductibles and co-pays, and that is why I have taken a rough estimate and said that with the $300 stipend, you could roughly cover normal usage of medical care coverage under normal utilization rates. If you were ultra high utilization, maybe you would exceed that. If you were low utilization, it might actually be money in your pocket.
Okay, fine. Thank you very much.
Representative Thompson.
I'm in a gray area here. Insurance isn't my thing. If two questions come to mind. Number one, if we have state employees that this is part of their benefit package, can we force them in one of them into this kind of a situation, or is that going to be the immediate court challenge because the benefit package is part of their compensation package, I would imagine, and the two of them, even though they're married, wouldn't have equal compensation packages for assuming they both have identical jobs, everything identical. One of them would have a reduced benefit package. And is that would that be a legal issue?
Co-Chair Thompson?
I'm not a lawyer, but I'm just posing that for discussion.
I appreciate you qualifying because I am not. It is my understanding that it would take legislation because you're dealing with a bargained for issue. And that is why within the amendments and some of the further discussions we're having, you need a date certain mark so that it could coincide with bargained for benefits.
And follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
The other question is on coordination of benefits. If you have two people in the same family, my understanding is they don't necessarily have full benefits in that if the benefits are properly coordinated, you're only going to get paid for a portion. You're not going to make cash on the deal. You don't get your doctor bill paid and then the other policy pays you for the doctor bill. You'd only get, at most, you'd have your doctor bill paid and the second coverage would pay maybe a deductible that you would have on that. So you might get more out of it, but you wouldn't make money on it.
Mr. Co-Chair, if I understand your question correctly, under the current system...
Okay,
well, under the current system with dual coverage, you're correct. The bill doesn't get paid twice, but it literally could get paid up to 100%, including the copay,
okay,
because you have the double coverage.
So that's what we're really looking at here, then.
Yeah, well, the significant savings here is that because the state chooses to cover on the family rate, you are saving on the premium payment.
Okay.
I mean, that's where the large savings here is on the premium payment. The agency will also come back and say, look, because all of these claims are within the same system, much of this will deal with the utilization rate of those receiving the benefit. But the true savings is the spot from paying twice for full family coverage. So it is the premium dollars being saved. And that's why when I'm using this rough calculation, I'm basically telling you the number of people divided by two, because you're only going to save half, the cost of the insurance less the stipend.
Yeah.
So it is very rough math and does not include actuarial tables yet to say what's the utilization rate look like within that, because all the cost still goes back to the same plan. I'm very convinced that there's significant savings.
Not questioning that. I'm just trying to figure out what the lay of the land is here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Hoyle.
Thank you, Speaker, for coming and testifying in front of our committee. And as this is probably one of the only committees that doesn't have any lawyers, I'm going to ask a question, and I apologize if you went over it. I just didn't understand. So you talked about having, in the next amendments, having a date certain that this would become effective. Would this be then prospective or retroactive? Would it affect people who already have benefits in PEP, or is it simply something prospective?
Mr. Co-Chairs, Representative Hoyle, the date certain would be a time in which it started, but in effect, it could then impact all folks covered under PEB.
Going forward.
Mr. Co-Chair, no. It's just that there would be a start date. If you have double coverage now, this would at some point eliminate that double coverage.
But it would be going forward, not...
Right. It wouldn't be retroactive to, we wouldn't back it up a year or half a year.
And I'm assuming that would be at the bargaining date, because that would be the time. I assume that's what they're talking about, putting in at the,
again,
at the contract expiration date or something.
Yeah, again, Mr. Co-Chair, this is where this gets a little bit gray, in that you would have to coordinate this piece of legislation with bargaining, but you would have to have the legislation in place to make permanency of it rather than a bargained issue.
I like this question. I'm not familiar with how extensive coordination of benefits goes, but I was just looking, for example, at an email that came from PED to the self-insured plan, and they were talking about a hip replacement, which would now be 15 or 30%. Copay, whether it was in network or not, plus $500 that was added to it. My guess is that in network benefit would probably end up costing a PEB member around $8,000 or $9,000 for just as a copay, 6 or 7, something like that. I mean, a large amount. Would that be coordinated benefits for people that had to, I mean, would it coordinate up to that whole amount, do you think?
Mr. Co-Chair,
I'm asking the wrong person.
Yeah, I think I've got a relatively good understanding of this. If you're talking about under the current system,
two members
carrying full coverage, I believe that you could receive up to 100% reimbursement, because you are basically overlapping one on top of the other.
Right.
So there's two ways to save, and I've not calculated any savings out of utilization reduction. But understand, I'm only talking about the gross difference in premium cost, but over time you're going to have a utilization reduction, because in a family there would be some cost for health care rather than 100%. So just by default, you'll have your utilization rate will go down some, or that's the prediction.
And if I can follow, the assumption is now of those calculations is that both members are getting free health insurance. So the extent to which that would be changed in a new contract, and I'm betting there's a fair probability that it won't be free to both of them. That would both reduce the desire to dual coverage if you had to pay them both, but also reduce some of the fiscal impact.
Mr. Chair, I would also suggest that if under the negotiations that are currently underway, members or participants within PEB were required to pay a portion of their health care cost, not only would it reduce the desire, it would also make the stipend for the one who didn't receive the benefit more valuable. Because now it would be, if we're both on the plan and now we're going to have to each pay $300 a month to stay on the plan, so you got $600 going out, now one of us stays on the plan and we get paid $300.
And that $300 might pay the insurance of the other.
There you go. I mean, so if that happens, that would actually be an additional benefit to this type of management of dual coverage within the PEB system.
Any other questions? Thank you for bringing us the bill.
Thank you, co-chairs, colleagues. I appreciate it greatly. Have a great afternoon.
Oh, yeah. can I call Bridget Burns, is it? Looks like an N. Darlene Weaver and Mary Botkin. And we'll go in that order.
Co-chair Greenlight, Co-chair Thompson, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. For the record, my name is Bridget Burns, and I'm the chief of staff for the Oregon University System. Today, I want to talk to you briefly about House Bill 2505, merely offering some friendly amendments that might improve the legislation for folks who work at the Oregon University System. It's my belief that there are some unintended consequences for this legislation that were not intentional. As it's written currently, House Bill 2505 would prohibit coverage of a family member who's a state employee but does not work sufficient hours to qualify for his or her own insurance coverage. We have a large number of employees that might not work a full 50% of the time, or if you're an SEIU unclassified employee, if you don't work up to 80 hours a month, you wouldn't qualify for your own insurance coverage, though you are technically a state employee. And if you are married to or domestic partner.
Could you introduce yourself?
I'm Bridget Burns. I'm the chief of staff for the university system.
I think
system.
You did. Thank you. I'm familiar.
He wasn't paying attention.
So we have a lot of employees that might be partnered with or married to someone who isn't a state employee that they would get their benefits through, and they also work for the state, but they don't work enough to qualify on their own. And so the unintended consequence is that you would have to choose between your benefits and your job. And I don't think that was intended, because if you don't qualify on your own, I think that the only amendment I would offer is that it says on line 19, it says the board may not adopt rules that allow a state employee to elect benefit plan coverage for a family member who is a state employee, and that's just a general statement. And perhaps it could say that it might not adopt to elect benefit plan coverage for a family member who qualifies for his or her own coverage as a state employee. So it requires that they are already receiving this coverage, and therefore it wouldn't be knocking people unintentionally off the plan. So
I don't understand what you said. But maybe
so
amendments get to. I mean, it seems to me what it's trying to do at least is I'm covered under my wife's plan. I now work for half time for OUS, and I don't qualify for benefits. Are you saying it somehow would take me off?
Co-Chair Greenlight, yeah. That would be the unintended consequence.
Don't want that to happen.
Yeah, and so it would just be a minor amendment that would specify that you would have to actually qualify for insurance coverage in order for this provision to apply to you. As I articulated, we don't think this was intended, and so we just want to speak up for those employees that work for us and do a variety of duties that don't receive full benefits. And with that, that's all I have to say, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Well, you answered mine. Thank you. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
Yes. Kind of sort out these relationships. If a married couple both qualify, full-time employees, both qualify for full insurance, which would be the present system, if they divorced but continued to live together, would they still qualify for full insurance?
Co-Chair Greenlight, Co-Chair Thompson.
That's presuming that would be a significant benefit.
If they weren't married and weren't domestic partners, they would no longer be the same family unit. They would each qualify separately, even under this.
Co-Chair Greenlight, Co-Chair Thompson, it's my impression that if a relationship between two parties is separated via a divorce or other proceedings, then they have separate contractual relationships with the state and therefore would not be affected. But I'm not an attorney, and I could also provide that information by speaking to my HR director and get that information
for you. This would imply then that state employees should live together but not get married, is that?
And not be formal domestic partners.
You can ignore that. You don't have to go there.
Is that the living in sin provision?
The living in sin provision, yes. We are encouraging state employees to live in sin or whatever, yeah. I'm looking for the... Is this the great deal...
It's not why they were living in sin. It's just why they're living in the same house.
Yeah, right. But is this the great deal it appears to be, or is it, you know, just a diversion that we may not get where we want to go? I guess is what I'm asking, but that's, you don't have to answer that. We'll work that out with the numbers. Mary's smirking. She knows the answer.
Okay. Weaver?
Good afternoon. My name is Darlene Weaver. I'm just a resident of Polk County, and I am a state employee. My husband is also a state employee. Generally, I'm opposed to the bill. I would much rather see state employees, all state employees, incur costs for premiums rather than just targeting couples or mothers and children that are working for the state. I think there's other ways to reduce the costs associated with health care. I do appreciate the proposal of $300 a month. I think that is much more incentive for a new employee than a new couple to consider when they're deciding whether to elect secondary coverage or not. I think currently when we signed up, I think the offer was $277 a year. So $3,600 a year is much more attractive. When discussion about kind of retroactive, you know, how this would affect people that currently have coverage, I guess I was a little concerned because there was discussion about, you know, bargaining units. You know, it'll come up when the bargaining takes place, but I guess I question, you know, if you're not a represented employee, how does that affect? And as far as the unintended consequences as well, if you had a mother and her son is 16 and starts working for the state, I believe that that child would be responsible for paying deductibles, and therefore the mother or father would also be responsible for paying those deductibles because a 16-year-old may not have enough money to pay for that. So maybe that's an unintended consequence. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
I do have one question.
Yes, ma'am.
The state of Oregon has full family coverage or two-party, whatever you need. So would that cover the child of a dependent of a state employee for insurance?
Are you saying if I had a child, would the insurance cover?
Well, you use the example of the 16-year-old child that would have to pay the deductible. And my question is wouldn't that child be covered under the insurance currently?
Right, but they would also be faced with the deductibles and... Oh, okay, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
I'm not educated enough to answer that question.
That's there and changing on these things. But right now, they're coming through 18 unless you're in college. And
that. So a child's coming.
Mary can answer that better, I think.
Yeah.
She knows everything.
Whitener has a question.
Actually, currently, they're covered up to the age of 26, your children.
If they're in college.
So they don't have to be in college anymore.
You mean under the new great federal plan?
Yes.
Yeah.
Because as a state worker, I know...
But before that, it was up to 23 if they were in college or something.
If they were in college, but now they don't have to be in college because...
Obamacare.
So state employees, if you have insurance and you're a state employee, your children are covered up to the age of 26, whether they're working or doing anything. So,
okay, let's move. Mary?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Mary Botkin. I'm here representing the AFSCME Council 75. And, Mr. Chair, I will remind you that you started out the discussion by saying you were sort of walking through a fog on this and you weren't sure. I am sharing your walk in the fog. I actually asked Diane Lovell, who sits on the PEB board on behalf of our union, about this bill, and she raised a whole series of issues. Not, you know, we are not here to oppose the speaker's bill. We understand where the speaker is going with this. We understand the motivation. But right now, all of this is it's intermixed in all the and the bargaining process that's occurring right now. So they're bargaining the economic package for state employees right now, we're working with SEIU on this, and they can speak for themselves.
And they are going to speak.
Yes.
How is that to join us? In fact, why don't you join us and take one of the chairs? Go ahead.
But I think that there some of the issues that have been raised are the same issues that we have had with the bill, and that is, what do you do when you have two people who both work for the state of Oregon and one works part-time and doesn't qualify for benefits and the other person is working full-time and covers the spouse with their full-time coverage because the individual who's working part-time does not qualify for benefits? And
there,
now,
there may be some problems with the drafting.
Yeah.
I don't think the bill intended that to happen.
I think
the bill
that is
only intends to deal with a situation where both members are each getting full family.
And I think that that is, and I think that probably the best thing for me to say right now is that we want to partner with the committee and with the speaker to find a solution that works.
That'd be great.
And
do it quickly.
And yeah. Yeah, that's it. I mean, I don't know all the answers to all the questions that have been asked. I think that the whole child, the dependent child, or the adult child, those are all issues that need to be addressed and need to be answered, and probably need to be answered by people with a much higher pay grade than mine and much more experience. In fact, Sandy probably knows more than I do about this.
And she's definitely not higher pay grade than you are.
I don't know about that. But be that as it may, I do think that there are a lot of issues intertwined in this, and I think that there are people who can help us sort of unravel the issues and find solutions. And it also, we need time to finish sort of the overall compensation discussions and figure out where we're going with that.
For us to work on it, we've got to have it posted for a work session by the 8th of April and acted on by the 20th of April. So if you want to get an influence on this, then I would say
do it now.
I mean, if we're going to work this bill, yeah, do it now and do it fast and get to a conclusion that you all can deal with. That would be very helpful.
And we're prepared to be a part of that discussion.
Yeah. Mr. Towers, do you have a piece to add to that?
Excuse me, Co-Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Arthur Towers, political director for SEIU Local 503. And just wanted to add a couple quick points. One piece is that we are concerned about the issue of two workers working side by side, having doing precisely the same work, having somewhat different total compensation packages. And so we did want to flag that issue. The second issue I wanted to flag,
especially if it turns out to be gender related.
Fair enough. The second issue that I wanted to raise is that over the course of time, there's been an improved coordination of benefits within PEB. The previous carrier for PEB did a poorer job than the current. Than the current carrier does in terms of coordinating benefits, and some of the urban legends that are out there have changed as a result. So I wanted to flag that. Thirdly, I am very interested in the point that the speaker made. I do appreciate the spirit in which he brought this bill forward to, by the way. Mm-hmm. But I am very curious about one of his comments where he was talking about the what the actuarial study will show when it comes to increased costs for the group as a whole. In other words, tens of thousands of people are covered by PEB right now, but all of a sudden we're going to have 2,300 fewer premiums coming in to cover that the cost for insuring that pool of workers. And so it just strikes me that the costs will rise to cover that expense. So we pay a composite rate right now, and so it seems likely that the rate will rise to cover that premium loss. That said, at the same time, we'll be paying out, in the speaker's example, $7.2 million per biennium, $1,000 per month time, or $300 per month times 1,000 recipients times 24 months in the biennium. Hopefully, the back of my envelope is working pretty well here. So we're just want to flag that. And then the final thing is just a comment that was made about the insurance being free. And according to the Department of Administrative Services study of total compensation for state workers, when you compare state workers to the private sector on wages alone, workers doing similar work end up earning about 80 cents on the dollar in wages. And so the now with the pension contribution and the insurance premium, that evens out almost to the penny. State workers make 97, 98 cents on the dollar. But so it feels like it's not quite free if your wages are less to make up for the to balance off the contribution to benefits. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would AFSCME or SEIU, if this is an opt-in thing for your members, they get a choice. I'm working, my spouse is working, we both have full coverage for full-time employees. Are you okay with it if one says, hey, I don't want to take the insurance, I'll take the $300 instead because I'm already covered under my spouse, we're both healthy, I would rather have the $300 than having the double coverage on the insurance? Are you in favor of letting your members have that choice?
Co-chairs, Representative Widener, we're open to the conversation. That's why we're not here in outright opposition to the bill. We're here to have the conversation, so that's what we want to look into.
Is that option available now?
I don't believe so.
Somebody can opt out. It just may not be.
Based on the notes that I have, and I'm strictly speaking from the notes that Ms. Lovell gave me, and they might be sort of shorthand, and I might be interpreting them wrong, but from what I can see, it does not appear to me that PEB has the authority currently to not cover a full-time, a qualified employee. I don't say that with any conviction because I'm not positive, and I think that's a very legitimate question, and I will find out the answer and get back to you.
I know when I was an OHSU employee, I had the option of opting out of medical but not dental based on having prior coverage, having existing coverage. But that was 10 years ago. President Doherty?
First of all, I appreciate you guys coming forward and saying you'd like to work with the co-speaker and so on in this, because the idea of either opting out of insurance or having double coverage or dealing with this is not a new concept. It's one in public and private sector negotiations has been fairly common. But saying that, it's usually a negotiated item, and it's not something that is kind of unilaterally done or done by an outside body. It's usually done through the collective bargaining agreement. And so, that's another avenue to do. But I think in this day and age of looking at all different options for insurance with the caveat of making sure that employees are covered, their families are covered, and that there's not a tremendous out-of-pocket loss from what they currently have is something to look at. So I appreciate you guys coming forward.
And I think that the other, going along with that, Mr. Chair, Representative Doherty, is the issue that what we don't want is we don't want a family to go without coverage because somebody opted out for a $300 bonus payment. What we want to do is be sure that the families are covered in total first and then figure out where we go from there. And that's why this is a very complicated issue, and I am certainly not overly qualified to be the person sitting at the table with you, but
okay,
I'll make sure somebody is.
Since you don't have anything to tell us anyway.
Terry Greenlick, if it's all right, we'd like to respond to Representative Doherty's comment about the... Mm-hmm. Speaker Hannah did mention that it is a matter of collective bargaining, but I do think that as PEB is moving forward, we're looking at the radical plan redesign changes that are under consideration. I think that in terms of real savings for PEB, that's where it's going to be as opposed to through this legislation. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. I'll close this hearing and open a public hearing on House Bill 3082. I'd like to have that hearing over by about 5 minutes after four, so I'm going to ask everybody to be brief. Representative Hunt, will you kick it off? We'll give you a few more minutes than everybody else, and we're going to hold all the other testimony to about 3 minutes.
Shouldn't take that long. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Representative Dave Hunt from Clackamas County. I would bring forward for your consideration House Bill 3082, which basically allows school districts who are currently out of OWEB. There are 15 districts across the state, and I believe you've got a chart that lists those 15 districts. 15 districts that are currently out of OWEB to stay out of OWEB. The dash four amendments, which you've just recently received, those merge together, the dash two and the three. So the two and the three together are reflected in the dash four amendments. They basically start with the principle that the system that is working, the system we have now for those 15 districts is working.
Dave, excuse me just a moment.
You bet.
Let me add the two other folks who are here to testify in favor to join you. As
you may.
That would be Tim Witcher and Greg Parrington.
Okay.
We ask you guys to join him. He needs protection.
Parrington's my bodyguard.
Pick the right one.
This one's Parrington.
I know.
Okay. And I should start off by saying I voted for OWEB. I think it was a good bill. I think it's been a good plan. I think OWEB has worked. It's created it's built a pool that is of an adequate size of school districts across our state that has achieved economies of scale. It's beyond a size that has achieved that economy of scale, and it saved money for those districts that are in OWEB. I represent two of those districts. Those two are not represented here today. At the same time, for those 15 districts that are out of OWEB, and again, you have the list of those, I believe that the current situation is also working, that those 15 districts have good insurance, good coverage, at a good cost, as you'll hear about from other folks who are here today. The one fundamental problem right now is that these 15 districts that are out, they have to, on a regular basis, go through this costly, time-consuming comparability process. All 15 of them have already been through it. All 15 have demonstrated that they are saving significant amounts of money by staying out. And this bill says that process, they shouldn't have to go through that process any further. This bill eliminates that costly comparability process. And so if this bill passes, districts that are in OWEB stay in, districts that are out of OWEB stay out, and that costly duplicative comparability process is eliminated, which ironically will save money not just for those 15 districts, but also for OWEB, because OWEB has some significant time-consuming costs on their side of doing the comparability study. And with that, I will stop and yield to my colleagues.
Wow. That is very... I've lost things. Oh, we have somebody else to add as well that I missed. Let's do Mr. Witcher now, and then if Debbie Johnson could join us as well when we get an empty chair here, that would be great.
Co-chairs Greenlick and Thompson, members of the committee. First of all, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today on this legislation for House Bill 3082. My name is Tim Witcher, and I'm the Director of Business Operations for North Clackamas School District. And by the way, I'm not living in sin, by the way, just so we're clear.
I swear to it.
We appreciate knowing that. Thank you for sharing.
I thought you might.
Thank you for sharing.
Okay. I'm the plan administrator for the self-insured medical and dental plans for North Clackamas. As Representative Hunt has already said, this bill, unlike maybe many other bills you have come before you, we're not asking for any money. This bill is actually a cost savings for both, hopefully, for the districts and for OWEB, because it will eliminate something that right now is not bearing a lot of fruit. Our district became self-insured in January 2000, and I remember going to meetings at that time and having discussions with people, and they were saying, why on earth do you want to be self-insured? Right now we just pay the bill, negotiate the rates, and we're done. And at the time, I remember kind of singing the company song, but I really didn't understand all the concepts involved with it. Over the course of time, it's proven to be a very instrumental thing in helping the district save money. There are a lot of people who went through a lot of steps to start the plan, from our superintendent and business managers when they first started the process, to our brokers who created a network from scratch and did a bunch of things so far as negotiating rates with PBMs and with stop-loss carriers and all those things, and like I said, creating the network. And basically, I say all those things to make sure that you understand that while we are self-insured, and that's a great thing, there's a lot of time and investment of resources that have gone into the formulation and maintenance of a self-insurance plan. And what we're asking is that that be acknowledged, number one, because it took a lot of it took leadership and vision to get that to be the case. When you talk about the consequences of your actions, I have a 16, 15, and a 12-year-old, and I'm forever telling them about the consequences of their actions and trying to preach that to them. Well, in this case, the district has taken the due diligence to create a plan, has been able to save money over time, and we're asking that the consequences of our actions be acknowledged and accepted as well. So far as the budget impact to the district, in the calendar year 2010, if we had been in OEB for us, the comparability had not worked out in our favor. That would have been an additional cost of $2.8 million in calendar year 2010. By OEB's own calculations for 2010-2011, our district would spend $4,788,000 additional to be in OEB for plans that are inferior to our plan. And I think that's important. When it comes to comparability itself, that comparability is also with the situation by OEB's own calculations that their plans for the self-insured plan for us are 6.7% less, actuarially speaking, than what our plan is. The law says that when you do comparability, the plans have to be within 2.5%. Our plans are 6.7% on the self-insured plan and 2.9% on Kaiser. That's a significant difference in the plans. Specifically for the comparability, we're concerned about the process being actuarially flawed. So it's a concern for us when we get compared against plans that are not the applicable apples for apples plans.
Speed it up.
Okay. I'll just skip most of it. Let me just say this one. The two-year interval that we are being currently asked to submit comparability is too short a period of time to actually enact any kind of change. When you talk to people who are involved with wellness and the other kind of cost containment features, they say it takes a minimum of 3 years to actually see a lot of the differences impacted in terms of your experience. The two-year cycle that we have here has the unintended consequence, probably, of having a situation where we cannot enact new features that will be ultimately cost-saving, because sometimes you have to spend money to save money. And if you have a situation where you're going to be up against OEB every 2 years and you need to make some investments in things that will cost money on the front end but save money down the line, you don't have that opportunity. We look at self-insurance as much like you look at your retirement. It's an investment that comes back to you over time. It's not something that you can necessarily look at year to year. And if you look at your retirement statements in the last 2 years, you probably would have stopped contributing if you could. But the deal is that over the course of time, the investment will be significant, and you'll actually make money, or you'll actually have some benefits in the process. We've included.
Please wrap it up.
Okay. We've included the districts that are self-insured or are not in OEB right now for your information, to the tune of about $34 million annually. And the thing is also significant that the head of our teachers union is here with us, not as opposed to us. So.
Okay.
Thank you.
Please keep it under 3 minutes.
Okay, I'll try. Co-Chair Greenlick and Co-Chair Thompson. I'm also here in support of House Bill 3082. My name is Greg Parrington, President of North Clackamas Education Association. We've had a good working relationship with our district in building these self-insured plans. It saves both our members money, our teachers use the plans, and it's very important to them. We looked at some of the comparable plans currently under OEB, and our plan currently is more robust. It offers better coverage, and it costs less. We also have provisions by Blue Shield Blue Cross, which is an opportunity that we have under OEB. OEB works for many districts, but we're fortunate that we're a large urban district and that we have access to a lot of hospitals as well as insurance companies that we can pick and choose from and design plans that fit the needs of our members. OEB is nice because it offers 9 different plans. We offer 3 to our members, but the plans that we get to choose and design specifically meet the needs of our teachers and of our staff. And so we've been pleased to be self-insured. We feel that there's money to be saved by not doing these comparability tests that are now under the law for every 2 years. And I think we would certainly join OEB if in time some of the plans look more similar to ours and if the affordability is there. So I don't think there needs to be a comparability test. It seems to be redundant because we are always looking for ways to save money because it benefits both, you know, the teachers as well as the district as well as the community. It's a better use of tax dollars. Thank you.
Wow, that's brief. I'm trying to ask a question. To what extent is the savings based on the fact that your teachers are younger than the average in the pool in OEB?
Our experience rate is, in our district, slightly, I think, better than OEB, but Tim probably has more of the specifics that he's been talking
I couldn't
about.
Speak specifically to it because I haven't seen OEB's information. However, the savings we have in here is not a product merely of demographics. Mm-hmm. Our plans are structured differently. They're different cost containment features, and the fact that we have probably a carrier with the most aggressive discounts is also probably a big part of why we are able to stand.
Thank you.
Okay. I have a few questions. First of all, with this legislation, Representative Hunt, the purpose of this legislation is basically so every 2 years the people that are currently self-insured and have been self-insured the whole time don't have to do the actuarial study?
Mr. Chair, Representative Doherty, yes. For those 15 districts, mm-hmm. Ashland, Beaverton, Bethel, Fern Ridge, High Desert, ESD, Medford, North Clackamas, Portland, although they have sure. 2 groups of employees. It's just the groups that are out, Springfield, Three Rivers, and Westland, Wilsonville. Yeah, and actually, I may have missed, maybe Corvallis and Central School District. I think that adds up to 15. In most of those cases, in fact, in 12 of those cases, in 11 of those cases, all of their employees are currently out of OEB. In 4 of them, they have some groups of employees that are in. Those would stay in. Some groups, like, in fact, I think in every case it's licensed teachers that are out, would stay out. And so just for those either districts or groups of employees in those certain 4 districts, they would be able to stay out without going through that costly comparability study. That would be the one change in this bill.
Can I have a follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And so the way that is, the whole purpose is not to open it up so a whole lot of people can come in and self-insure. Is that what the purpose is? And the reason I'm asking that is you know what it's like to go through and all of a sudden self-insure when you were with a major group, and it's quite an extensive process and very expensive and so on. So your concern are only the 15 districts that currently are self-insured. It would not open it up to other districts to all of a sudden say, I want to self-insure.
Mr. Chair, Representative Doherty, that is absolutely correct.
Okay.
Are they all, the 15 aren't all self-insured?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Representative, I think the question was, does it allow any districts that are currently in OEB to decide to self-insure?
Correct.
And the answer to that is no, this bill does not do that.
Okay, that was it. And then follow up is, I congratulate, I'm also a former president of North Clackamas Education Association. So.
Wow, it's an old home week.
It's a small world.
It's on the wide.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's probably for Representative Hunt. And Representative Doherty actually got into it a little bit, but this is just limiting to these districts. If another district wanted to self-insure, they could still go through the process and be able to show that they can save money and self-insure, or are they obligated to OEB once they're in it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, the only change that this bill makes is eliminating the comparability study for those 15 districts. And I say districts or employee groups within those districts that are currently out. That's the only change in the statute.
So they don't have to do it every 2 years?
So you don't have to do it, period, correct?
Once you're in, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Under the current law, I think once you're in.
I represent one of the districts that has part of their employees – not in OEB, and for them, they've said that this would be a cost savings, this would be a time savings, and, you know, they've already shown that they have, that it has been better for them. And there's a fair amount of teacher tenure in Bethel, so it isn't that there's a younger population, but it has worked out well. But, again, I appreciate you bringing this forward, and my understanding is that this isn't going to change the systems that we have. That would, if we were going to do that, it would be a separate bill, but would allow just for them to be more efficient and not have to spend money on something that is duplicative and not particularly useful. I mean, that's what my district's telling me. Is that what you...
Yes.
Yes, good afternoon, Co-Chair Greenlake, Co-Chair Thompson, and members of the committee. I will not repeat what has already been said. Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Debbie Johnson, RN. I am the Health Resource Coordinator who manages the health benefits for Beaverton School District employees, retirees, and their dependents. We are in favor of House Bill 3082 with the added amendment to remove the every two-year actuarial analysis currently required under the statute. As you know, our resources have continued to be severely limited for K through 12, and the savings that we achieve through collaborative efforts with our bargaining associations and our employees are actually bringing savings to the classrooms. Beaverton School District has been actively engaged since 2007 in providing constructive input and monitoring the effects of OEB. What we'd like to tell you is that we are very grateful for Senate Bill 901, which was passed in the 2009 legislative session by Representative Senator Bonamici. And because of that being added to statute, all of the 15 districts have been blessed with a reprieve this year from doing the comparability study. And all of those districts last year did pass. Our first study was in 2009. We were $4.1 million less costly than OEB for comparable plans. In 2010, we were $7.9 million less expensive than OEB for comparable plans. This equals 79 teaching positions for Beaverton. We disagreed with OEB's initial 2010 analysis and asked them to provide the required percent differences that Tim referred to on our comparability report. They advised us that they would not be able to expend additional consultant time to this because we had already shown that we were less expensive, even though this is required in their own administrative rules. They stated they were over budget at the time and their consultants' fees would not redo the analysis. I do want to share with you that our health care premium renewals with our carriers, Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield, Kaiser Permanente, and Willamette Dental, for the last 4 years have remained in single digits. This year, we're proud to announce, as of July 1, 2011, we are receiving a 0% increase from Regents, and this plan carries 60% of our employees. We will receive an increase of 12% for our Kaiser plan. But even with these increases that we have on the Kaiser plan, we are able to offer full-time employees a full family medical, vision, prescription, and dental plan for a cost that's under the district cap of $1,094 a month. There is one plan that exceeds that cap by $156.60. So to wrap up, what are the keys to Beaverton success? We are collaborative and we educate our employees. We have a long history of working with our employees, our associations, and our health plan carriers. All employee groups have the same district contribution. We all have access to the same health plan combinations, and our carriers and our consultants give us feedback on our utilization and our experience. Number two, our employees and retirees use their resources wisely and conservatively, and our office provides them with education on the health plans, and as an RN, I provide a confidential resource for them for their health questions and health issues as they arise. They also use the resources available through their health plans. Plan designs and efficiencies. We have three plan combinations.
Please wrap up. You wrap up.
Okay. And so it's our plan designs and efficiencies that keep our costs down, and we provide full family coverage. There's no financial incentive. You do not get money if you do not elect insurance. It's all for one and one for all. So in these times of limited resources, I ask for your consideration and support for House Bill 3082. Thank you for your time today.
I have a question. Mr. Chair. Okay, it'll be quickly. And part of this is a comment. I want you guys, I've worked with self-insurers. I worked out of the Beaverton office. I know some of the problems that they had 10, 15 years ago with self-insured, and a lot of you have been self-insured for a long time. But I want to make it very clear. There are school districts that are saving millions and millions and millions of dollars with OED plans. And so I don't want to make the impression that you know, OEB school districts are not saving money or participants, because they are. It's just that the advantage that some of the people that have self-insured is that you've been self-insuring for a long time, have a long-time relationship with Blue Cross, who's not an OEB carrier, and have been able to go through and bargain more of the need for the specific group as opposed to an entire network system. And I know that Beaverton was able to do things that were strictly just for Beaverton, which is a very good thing. And it's been self-insured for a long time, very good program, but it's not for everybody, and there are districts that do save millions and millions with OEB, so I just want to make that clear.
Thank you, Representative Doherty.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Doherty, I agree completely. In fact, I tried to start my testimony with exactly that. I believe it's actually been tens of millions. I think OEB has saved tens of millions just over the last few years, and that's why this bill doesn't try to mess with that success.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for bringing us this point. Can I have Justin Black and Trish Smith? She's
Mr. Chair.
Trish, yes, sir.
May I make a comment while they're coming up? I think that the question that we're asking with these comparability studies may be the wrong question. The question that we're asking is, would it cost the district more or less to participate in OEB? And the question that I think we care about is, does their participation or non-participation in OEB cost the state more or less? And does it help us as a state move towards more, better outcome, lower cost health care or not? And I think they're actually not the same question. They may appear to be the same question, but what happens in an individual district's experience is not necessarily what's happening statewide. I just want to make sure we're asking the right question.
That's always been my concern. My concern is the effect that keeping these people out has on the overall risk pool and the overall cost. I mean, all the money comes from the state anyway. And the question is, how is it affecting the state expenditures? But we would have to find a way, if we were going to assist them something different, to mitigate the cost of the school district, certainly in the short and intermediate term. Mr. Black, you have just a few minutes.
Co-Chair Green, Co-Chair Thompson, members of the committee.
I will be in opposition right now.
I will be very brief. My name is Justin Black. I'm from the Oregon Education Association. We represent about 45,000 educators throughout the state, most of whom receive their health benefits through OEB. We believe that OEB is helping members and school districts from around the state avoid paying more for their health care now than they would be without OEB. The increased purchasing power of OEB has given our members an opportunity to negotiate better contracts, both with insurance companies and health care providers. OEB has given our members a chance to participate in programs that will improve their overall health over the long run, which also will bring down costs over the long run. Our members did not have access to those programs prior to OEB. We also believe that the comparability provision in OEB creates a safety net for districts that are currently out by creating a standard for districts outside of OEB to meet or beat. As long as they are able to do this, they stay out. If OEB... skip that. Last year, Senator Bonamici wrote Senate Bill 901, which extended the yearly comparison every 2 years or sooner if requested either by the district or the employee group. The bill created more flexibility for districts while still leaving intact a safety net. House Bill 2082 would eliminate the safety net and would not set a bar for districts to strive for. And we have huge concerns that if a district were to become more expensive than OEB, more money would be expended and they would not enter OEB, and our members would end up paying more out of pocket for their health care than they would inside OEB, and the district in turn would end up paying more. By having the comparability study at least every 2 years, there is a check-in of, are they still saving money, or would OEB be the more beneficial way to go? It is also good to remember that Senate Bill 426, which created OEB, also created a legislative task force to be created this summer to look at OEB and suggest legislation to the legislature to make it better. That task force is scheduled to begin its work on July 1st and report to the next legislative session. I believe this topic would be a good one for them to look at and study and make sure that the comparability studies are done in a prudent manner, one that does not put too much on the districts, and that is not too expensive for the districts. So I think there is a check-in on this point, and a time for them to look at. I do want to take a moment to congratulate North Clackamas and Beaverton for controlling their costs at the local level. I hope that someday they will take the chance to share their best practices with OEB, because I think overall we agree with one thing. We would like to bring health care costs down for our members and down for school districts across the state. And I will stop there.
Senator Hoyle.
So for any one of these districts, when they would go to re-up and determine what kind of coverage they would have for their employees, would they not then be able to consider OEP and be able to ask for rates and coverage and plans at that time? Because they can't opt out, but they could opt in at that time without a comparability study, just like you would on the market with any other insurance?
Yeah, I think we do have some concern. Co-Chair Greenlake, Representative Hoyle, I think we do have some concerns that that may not happen, that they may not take the time to do the comparability study, that really by doing it every 2 years, they at least have a check-in, they have a bar to strive for.
Just a follow-up, please.
Go for it.
So, you know, for most of our school, and I'm most familiar with my school district, and I understand what you're saying, and I appreciate that. And if there is another path to get this done, I'm certainly willing to consider that. But for most school districts who are looking to get the best services to children possible, make sure that we keep the best employees possible, and reward our employees, then they're going to look for what is the best plan at the best cost. So we could mandate that there should be a comparability study, and I would say that the one that is currently, the process that we currently have is, it's difficult. It's difficult to do. But why wouldn't I, as a school district, look at every option possible without having that be mandated? If I'm looking at a market, I'm going to look at the entire market, and as OEP gets better buying power and presumably gets better cost control and better costs, why wouldn't the school districts then be incented to go into OEP through a market?
Co-Chair Greenwich, Co-Chair Thompson, Representative Hoyle, I agree with you. I think we have every hope that a district would do that. I think there are some concerns that a district has so much invested in being self-insured or blazing their own path that they feel like they have invested too much time and effort in their current system to switch. We want our members and school districts to go the best possible path and to give them the opportunity to do that.
Okay, last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just because you kind of got me there. Most of your budget committees are volunteers or citizens. So you're going to tell me citizens are going to have too much invested to where they wouldn't look at, because they want their children are being educated there, so they're going to make the decision, hey, I don't want to lose teachers. It's cheaper at OWEB, so let's get our insurance there versus over here. So the people that are working there don't make that decision. It comes out of the budget committee, which is private volunteer citizens, and they want what's best for the students. So wouldn't they choose OWEB if it was cheaper?
Co-Chair Greenlake, Co-Chair Thompson, Representative Widener. I believe that at the district level, most of the decisions about which insurance carrier to use actually lie within the district and not in the budget committee, with superintendents and business managers specifically.
But those, if I can follow up real quick,
go ahead.
Those come. I mean, I have good friends who sit on these committees. Those are brought to them to decide which one do we want to do in our negotiations, or usually when they're negotiating a contract with the teachers as well, and it's brought up part of the negotiation package. So they see all of that information that's brought to them, or at least in our districts. I don't know, maybe you work in districts that don't aren't doing that type of stuff.
Yeah, Co-Chair's Representative Widener. It varies district to district. We have insurance committees that involve both administrators and employees and possibly members of the citizen or part of the public, but we also have other districts where the decisions are made by administrators only and don't include our members. So it varies from district to district, and that's why, you know, having a check-in every 2 years. And I will say to the committee, you know, I think it's important that, you know, there is a task force to look at this summer. I think if this process is overly burdensome to school districts, that that by the next time school districts are going through this process, there's going to be a check-in on the process. So I don't think there's a rush to make a change in how it's done now without a real independent study happening.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Last call for Tricia. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3082, and open up a work session on House Bill 3137. Let's see if we can get as much more of the committee together as we can. Just stand down for a second until we try and get.
Oh, but Lori is in there.
Lori, you want to join us at the front?
This is a separate issue.
Canada's right outside. He'll be in a just a
moment. Oh, okay. You want to stand at
ease? I am at ease. We are at ease.
Did you turn the page?
2:30. I think we're off the phone.
In this session, we're in a work session on House Bill 3137. Let me make a sort of introductory statement on behalf of Representative Thompson and I, and he can comment on it when we're done. What we have an opportunity with this bill to produce a House, our House version of what the exchange should be. The Senate is working diligently on a plan. They are now on the -5 amendments to their plan that's keeping Lori busy. What we have in front of us is a slight modification of what was the -2 amendments to the to the Senate bill, and it's in your packet. And Lori's going to walk us through that. The intention today is for us to all get familiar with what's in this amendment, which is where we start our discussion. Jim, did you have a question?
Yeah, just real quick. I believe the Senate passed that out to us yesterday.
Ways and Means.
To Ways and Means.
Well, pardon me. It went from the subcommittee to the full committee.
Okay, yeah, I thought it was coming to us. Then
it will go to Ways and Means. I'm quite certain. I mean, okay. If it came to us, then we have a different issue. But my belief is it's going to have to go to Ways and Means.
For life.
And what we're trying to do is to also send something to Ways and Means that will have the ability to get a consistent version down there. If it can come to the Senate floor and to our committee while we still have time to deal with it, then we'll deal with it.
We may want to check. I don't. Lori was there, but I thought they passed it to us. I didn't think it went to Ways and Means.
You mean they passed it to their full committee?
Right.
To the full committee, yeah.
The full committee is where they're going to decide.
Okay.
Well, I don't see how this can avoid going to Ways. Do you? I mean, they told us anything that takes $1 of general funds or more than $10 of, $10,000 of other funds, the speakers reiterated that to us today, is going to Ways and Means. And I don't see how this could not have a fiscal.
Chair Greenlick, I know that the position that's being taken, it's all going to be funded with federal grants, so it wouldn't have a fiscal, but, you know, that's
other
not
funds.
My job.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and fees. Anyway, if it comes that route, that would be great. That would be, in our mind, the preferable route. That they get it through the process, get it out of the Senate floor, and get it to us in time to be worked on in the policy committee. We would be delighted if that's the way it's coming. And then we'll, instead of starting with this, we'll start with that. But I think the process we're going through in the meantime should educate us so we know where the issues are that we can deal with there. And I haven't seen the -5s. I mean, I haven't looked at them. I have a copy in my office.
It was my understanding that we would be getting the Senate bill through the policy route for essentially the same reason as Lori just reiterated, that for some reason it is deemed not to have a fiscal because it's all federal outside funding.
At this stage.
Yeah. I'm halfway with you until the bill is out of the Senate and our able assistant has it in her hot little hands. It's not here.
Yeah, we started this because Representative Thompson and I had both heard the plan was to send it to Ways and Means and then send it straight to the floor with us having any chance at the policy committee to deal with it. That's what set, you can imagine, Jim and my both hair on fire, and that's why we don't have any hair left.
Yeah, right.
They're all burned off.
I want to thank you for causing it to spill over.
And here's what I hope we can do as we become educated. I don't think we want to get mired in the process that the Senate did, which was getting 105 amendment suggestions for every time they had a new amendment. What I would hope we can do, as I say, Jim and I have both talked about this, is develop a process where we look at this and then figure out what the policy issues we need to deal with. There are, for example, some very obvious policy issues. One is some things about the makeup of the board. There's been some angst on some people. One is the question of whether the board can have the power to negotiate for price among the plans or to restrict the amount of plans that the amount of plans that can come in from any insurer. There are, I think, maybe at most 4 or 5 significant issues. We thought we would ask our our vice chairs to keep an eye on the discussion. We have a little problem because we understand Representative Kenmare's had a little bit of a health problem, but we're hoping he'll be back by the next time we have to deal with this. Ask the vice chairs to keep track of the policy issues and then take some testimony on those issues, hear from folks, but not try and create a new draft. I'm sure you'll be happy to hear this. A new draft of a bill every time we get some testimony. Instead, to find out what we can get five votes on in this committee for one or the other of the positions on these key policy issues, put them together, and then try and draft a single bill, a single next version that we can all look at and find out if that's what we agreed to, and then whether we have the votes to send that on from that model. And if we can do it without a Ways and Means referral, does 3731 have an existing Ways and Means referral?
Yes, Mr. Chair, it does.
So we would have to get that rescinded or send it after we see what what the bill is. But we'll be hearing this virtually every committee we can. They have some time. Representative Thompson and I will alternate the chair in the times we hear it. We really believe that this bill cannot get out of the building without relatively strong buy-in from both the Republican caucus and the Democratic caucus of the House. We think that's going to be the critical choke point on that. So what we're going to try and do is to work out a bill that both of our caucuses feel comfortable enough to get 15 or 16 or 20 votes from both caucuses, and we think that's a challenge. Yes, sir.
I think we better look at more than five votes out of this committee then if we want to get 15 votes out of both caucuses.
Absolutely. But if we don't get five votes, then we don't have anything.
But I think we're going to need seven to get something that would be viable, to eight.
I mean, our objective is to get something that will at least be moderately acceptable to both caucuses. And if we don't do that, then we'll wait for the Senate bill and see what happens then. Okay. Any other comments before we ask Lori to work us through this? And please ask questions as we go along. Make sure we have enough time. We'll keep... If we don't get this done by 5 o'clock, then it'll be the first order of business the next time.
And it is on the agenda for Monday, Mr. Chair?
Yeah. We're going to have it pretty much on the agenda, at least for some time in every session.
You can open it up.
You want to start through?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Lori Freeman from the Office of Legislative Counsel. I'm here to walk you through the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3137. The first section on the first page has our usual definitions that apply to all of the new sections we're creating. Page 2 creates the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange Corporation. It's established as a public corporation.
Hold on. Let me just ask a question. Let me just point something out, and we'll stop one section at a time. Why don't you finish Section 1, and then we'll...
Section 1 is the definitions.
And includes the one on the top of page 2.
That's correct.
I just want to point out to you that one of the things that confused me looking at this the first time is the definition 5 is talking about a health plan. And some of us tend to think about health plans as insurance companies. But in this meeting, we're talking about a health insurance company presenting a plan. And there might be 3 or 4 different plans by a single insurance company. So a health plan here does not mean a health insurance company. It means a single plan offered in the exchange by any different health insurer. And in fact, there will be the notion of bronze, silver, and gold, or whatever it is, different plans that could be offered, different health plans that could be offered by an insurance company. Am I reading that correctly, Laura?
Yeah, you're exactly right, Mr. Chair.
It confused the hell out of me through about 3 different versions of this. So I realize.
One of the problems we had to overcome in this is the common use of the word health plan and used interchangeably with the insurer and the actual product that's put forward. So that's why we have these definitions. You know, we have a health plan as the actual product, and then we have insurers.
Good.
Section 2 on page 2 creates the Health Insurance Exchange Corporation and, as I said, establishes it as a public corporation, so it would be akin to SAFE or OHSU with some differences. On page 2, lines 12 to 14 clarify that the exchange is not intended to overlap the regulatory responsibilities of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Subsection 2, which starts on line 15, sets out the mission. And 2A is the triple aim.
Mama Jumbo, right?
I'll let you give you a second to just read through those rather than read them
triple
for
A,
you.
Triple A, mumble jumble. Mm-hmm. Okay, some questions?
I think you and I had a question about the triple aim. You know, Wednesday night section says... I can't remember what you referred to it as, but I seconded the motion.
Triple A mumble jumbo.
Okay. I'm not sure that maybe the word goal is okay, but it's...
There is an issue here that I guess I want to raise again. I raised before and given up on it, and that's the on line 12 through 15, and maybe we ought to at least cite it as an issue. There, I still believe it is an important question of whether the DCBS ought to be the power for regulating health insurance rates for products in the exchange or whether it ought to be the exchange that does that. This argues that the current version of using DCBS to regulate health insurance, to have health insurance rate review, will still continue even for products in the exchange. I think that's at least an issue. It's not one that I'm willing to go to the mat over, however, but other people may feel differently about that. I think that's basically the only substantive issue in here, right, Lori, in Section 2?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Why would we not want DCBS doing it? Isn't that their expertise?
Well, you know, it was a major issue in 2009 as well. There is a group that feel DCBS doesn't do as an effective a job of insurance rate review as the health authority could do it. But the question is specifically in the exchange, if the exchange is involved in managing the program inside the exchange, you could argue that ought to be the place where they should have it. They should have the ability to at least be regulating rates. The last governor felt very strongly that it should be in DCBS. I'm not sure how this governor feels. But it's not an issue I would like to see us hung up on.
Sounds like we need to have a talk with DCBS about how they do their work, if that's, you know.
I think they're doing it a lot better. Mm-hmm. And there's apparently a Senate bill. Is that right, Laura? Are you involved in that? 91 or 93 or something that has some other things about how... So
yeah, they testified on it yesterday. So DCBS came in and talked about the exchange and the billing, how they handle all of that. So
great. Lori, thank you. Any other questions on Section 2?
One more general. Before we get too far into this, I understand we have dash 4s from the Senate. Is
dash that where we... Dash 5s.
Dash 5s, okay. Are we intending to look at the differences between these and dash 5s when we get them?
I was suggesting not. I was suggesting that we just work off of this and figure out what we want. It certainly wouldn't stop anybody from reading the dash 5. I just got so hopefully confused as it kept getting worse and worse going from...
I'm assuming there's something in the dash 5s that's not in this section, or in this dash 2.
Well, there were lots of things in the dash 3 and 4. They just weren't very good things.
Oh.
I can get you copies of the dash 5.
No, I can
I
do
think
that.
They sent them out.
I'm trying to lay out the process here because... If
do you have a brief comment on that? Or the dash 5?
We're going to get the dash 5 bill from the Senate. It seems like we should be evaluating what they did.
I would say if we're going to get a Senate bill, then we ought to go back to starting from that and trying to compare to where we are.
Okay, so you want to, you're thinking about
if we're getting a
this,
Senate bill.
Okay, and then looking at the Senate bill side by side or in addition to?
If we get it, absolutely.
Okay.
So Widener?
Yeah. I would kind of suggest that we grab what the Senate's done with their dash fives and everything, because everybody came in and it seemed like it had a lot of agreement when it went out. I think it went out unanimous, but going through that and comparing the two and bringing them to cut work back on Lori, because
how different is the dash five?
Representative Greenlick, the five, I'm just going off the top of my head, it made some changes to things, but I don't believe it added anything. It had a lot of clarifying language in it. It changed the conflict of interest or the qualifications for board membership with respect to conflict of interest, and it changed the civil penalties so that they would only apply to navigators and the exchange would only be imposing it, not DCBS. But other than that, I think it was, for the most part, clarifying changes.
Well, I suggest we work through this, get our own things in mind, and if the Senate bill comes, but although any of us ought to look at the dash fives and see if there are things in there that we see as dealing with the kind of issues we want to deal with, that would be very useful.
I'm just assuming the dash fives, threes, fours, and fives, must have things in it that are going to be issues, items, or there wouldn't be a difference in from two, three, four, five.
Well,
and whatever those issues are, we ought to examine those as well.
I know there was a large group of folks who came to me after the dash threes and said it would cause them to recommend no votes on the whole bill if the dash threes stayed in place, and they had a bunch of problems. And I didn't know whether they got changed after that. But I thought going back to a bill where people were much more neutral on versions, which were the twos.
Okay. We can do that.
It was a safer place to start.
Mr. Co-Chairs, I do have the dash fives with me, so if it, I could at some point go over the differences if you'd like, or I could maybe highlight
thing.
Them as we go.
Yeah.
And Rocky could come up and help us, or Rocky King could come up.
Thanks for your advice. Is there somebody else here?
I'm sorry?
Is there somebody else?
No. I was just saying Rocky.
I heard you.
Okay.
Okay. Did you want me to tell you the changes in the dash five as we go?
No.
Okay.
No. Let's do that on a different session.
Let's see. Where were we?
Threes?
Section three, which starts on page three, sets out the duties of the corporation. And that's to administer a health insurance exchange, and that's a defined term, meaning an exchange as prescribed by federal law. To also set up a website that provides information and offers the opportunity to purchase health insurance. Another duty is to certify, decertify, or suspend qualified health plans. In other words, determine whether or not they may participate or be offered through the exchange. To facilitate enrollment in qualified health plans and in the medical assistance program. And this is also out of the federal law, a requirement that there be sort of a seamless point of entry for both health insurance and the medical assistance programs. To gather and submit information to the appropriate state and federal entities so that they can determine tax credits, the exemptions from the individual mandate, eligibility for cost sharing. And those are really the high points in Section 3. If you have any questions, I'll give you a second to scan through that.
Lori, can you talk a little bit about the section sub I down through? I don't see specifically. You go through sub I. In those next few sections, that would be subsection would be very helpful.
Chair Greenlick, you want me to start with I? Or?
Yes.
Okay. I assist individuals and groups to enroll in qualified health plans and, if appropriate, collect and remit premiums. The idea here is that the corporation would have the ability, if they chose to do it this way, to actually collect premiums from individuals or employers and pay them over to the health insurers, but it's not required. But their duty is definitely to assist people in enrolling in health plans through the exchange. Paragraph J, facilitate community-based assistance with enrollment by awarding grants to entities that are certified as navigators. Navigators is another requirement of the federal law, and these are entities that receive grants, and their federal money comes through the state to give grants to navigators who will help people make decisions about health insurance, enroll in health insurance, and facilitate the purchase of health insurance.
They were hire and train people, and I've heard there are organizations like the Farm Bureau or AARP or other kinds of...
Representative Greenlick, yes. Any entity that has meets the criteria in the federal law, which, I'm sorry I don't have it with me, but it's something like you have the ability to perform the duties that would be required of a navigator, and I know there's a preference for organizations that already have an established relationship in the community. So I've heard Farm Bureau. It could be agents and brokers. It could be any organization.
On these navigators, I understand they're specified in the federal law, but looking at rural Oregon, and we're going to have this conversation a lot, who is that presumed to be? I mean, we don't have a huge volume of organizations in many of the rural counties in Oregon, and it seems to me that that this part sets us up for failure because we don't have an identified way of... I mean, what happens if there aren't any navigators? I mean, there are parts of Oregon that are pretty remote where this program is going to apply, and they don't have the benefits. I mean, I can see how with community organizers and whatnot in Portland, urban areas, we could have all kinds of people available and willing to do this. But and I go back to the SHEBA program, where we have a lot of areas of rural Oregon. There are no SHEBAs.
Well, but those are volunteer programs. I mean, I would assume, a Chamber of Commerce would be a logical program.
But, you know, I've used it before, and I don't know about the Chamber of Commerce, but the Harney County, you know, or someplace like that, you've got miles and miles of property with few people, but they are still entitled. And how do you reach into those areas with navigators where you don't have a Chamber of Commerce? I'm speculating on that. How do we get a provision in here that covers the entire state of Oregon? I guess is my question. Equal representation or near equal representation for the whole state.
Coordination.
And, I've heard the Farm Bureau brought up several times. Well,
Chamber of Commerce, yeah. Cattlemen's Association. I mean, I'm assuming.
But it starts with they're going to want to do it.
There's going to be money to pay them to do it.
Yeah.
Acorn Bus Project.
Pardon me?
Acorn Bus Project.
Acorn in Harney County?
Acorn is big in Harney County, I understand. That'd be a very logical one.
But this is the kind of thing I'm looking at. We're building in a classical rural-urban
divide. I think Oak Tree would be better.
And if we don't have a way going in to address this, we're going to have really good coverage in urban parts of the state and lousy coverage every place else for this particular part of it.
And in the urban areas, it's probably less vital because it's probably more resources.
You may be right. I'm thinking this.
It's a very important issue.
I'm thinking about relatively poor people, for lack of a better word, that don't have a lot of access living in in the backcountry, and we really want to get them involved in this program. And how do we do the outreach to find them and serve them through a navigator program? I just don't believe without effort this is going to work out very well.
One of the things we ought to examine is what we did with Healthy Kids, because there was a process just like that. We've been pretty effective at getting Healthy Kids, but it'd be interesting to see what they did in the rural areas.
Is there any data on what our penetration is in the more rural parts of the state compared to the more urban parts of the state?
It'd be interesting to
ask. Doesn't have to be equal, because things are never really equal, but is the attempt equal, or is the access relatively available?
Would you feel comfortable asking Kathy Kaufman to come in and?
Well, I think I'm throwing the question on the table. I don't need an answer right now.
I think that's an issue
with the whole Navigator program. If, just for instance, we have a large area that nobody applies to be, that nobody asks for the grant to be the Navigator there, are we going to go out and establish a Navigator in those areas, or are those areas just left out in the cold?
Mr.
Chair. Because we are rural, underpopulated, and things like that.
Representative Hoyle was first.
Representative Hoyle, yes. And you next?
I was not referring to your district, Representative
and
Hoyle.
And Representative Widener.
Actually, you were referring to my district. In working for the United Way, we were one of the organizations that stepped up to enroll kids in Healthy Kids. And the reason we did that was Lane County had one of the lowest enrollments because we didn't have a natural base of places for we didn't have people that stepped up, and this is in Lane County and some of the more rural areas of Lane County. Our outreach from United Way, we specifically go to rural school districts that had more than 50% of the kids living at or below the poverty level. So I think that it is a real concern. There are rural areas and frontier counties that were very successful in that outreach, like in Northeast Oregon through the Northeast Oregon network, that collaborative. But they had somewhat of an existing infrastructure and worked. But I think I'd go back to I need, I don't know about anybody else, but I need a definition of what is a navigator, because the work that we did with Healthy Kids and the outreach and enrolling those kids was different. What is a navigator? What are we defining as, let's have a definition. Navigator, broker, services needed, because I think that's what we're talking about. But I want to know what is a navigator.
Could you give us what the federal regs are on that? Federal definition? Because I think that's the definition
right.
We're using.
Okay. I understand we're conforming to federal law. I'm just not sure how well federal law fits here.
Let's get the definition and see what we're talking about.
Yeah, co-chairs, the citation on line 18, that's the description of, or that's the section in the federal law that describes what navigators do.
Could you give us that?
Yes, I can. I would be happy to do that.
I think Mr. Widener is first.
Representative Widener.
I think Representative Hoyle kind of went there, and it's something I've had issues with, too, because it seems like we're putting more bureaucracy in place with agent, navigator, and we're going back and forth there. And my concern is, why don't we just, because I know we had this discussion the one day in committee when you were there, of agents are getting 3%, then you got a navigator who's getting paid. Why don't we just let the agents be the navigators? And they
don't want to get paid that way.
So
they want to get paid on a commission basis. And there is a room for, I have put the navigators, the agents in here. We'll get to that. I think it's on page 14. Yeah.
Well, to me,
there is room for
if
agents.
We called them navigators and didn't pay them anything, let them work off commission, then they have to go get people signed up to get paid, which I'm okay with that. But we get rid of that paid navigator then and just have an agent as the navigator, and they get paid on commission by the people that they sign up. Would make more sense to me.
If you go to page 14, line 9, you'll see how I propose agents being used in addition to navigators. But I think the navigators can be very useful, and they are paid with federal grants. Is that right?
Yes, Representative Greenlick.
As opposed to going into the cost of insurance. So,
well, and the agent is a navigator. We could pay him off
agents,
the federal money.
Well, the agents can apply for navigator contracts. There's nothing that stops them. But then they work under the model of the navigators, which is hiring people and employing them for in short-term jobs to serve that function. But I think there's room for both. I think a navigator, there's nothing that stops a group of agents from applying to be a navigator under that definition, I believe. But they can also work independently as agents.
So when the feds cut off the money for the navigators, then how does the navigator get paid? Does the state have to pick up the burden at that point?
Well, I think that's an interesting question.
Because right now there's no funds at the federal level to even start to pay for this program. So with the navigators, and to me, keeping it a commission base, and then we could pay them their commission out of what comes from the feds.
Well, I think we need to remember there's always the probability if we don't get an exchange, the fallback position will be we'll use the federal exchange. I mean, we'll be forced into the federal exchange, whatever that model is.
Which, and one of the things is as a state, we can push back and tell the feds, you will pay for this, and you'll pay for all of our agents, because it's your program, you're going to pay for it. You're not going to throw this on us and make us pay for it as a state when you drop the ball on a program you throw at us.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, we have the absolute option, which I think is a real option, to say, we're not going to try and do this as a state. We'll just wait till the feds come in and do it under the federal plan. That's how we push. I mean, that's the only pushback option we have. But I'm perfectly willing, and this is the thing that's been important. If we can't come to consensus on a plan, then I'm perfectly willing to sit back and let the feds do it. I think that's a least good option, but that's what will happen if we can't produce a bill.
There are states that have. Utah has theirs. It was like $600,000, I think, for putting their exchange together. So, but I think we need to have something in here, start going after the feds, saying you're paying for this.
Well, they are paying for it.
So.
For the setting it up and for the navigators. They are.
And continuation forward.
That,
so
they,
not one time money.
No, I think they want us to be self-sufficient by the time we get set up. That's not a bad objective. And that's where fees are in there for that reason.
She stepped out.
We lost Doherty. Okay. Next section.
Okay. Paragraph K, which starts on line 20. This again. I'm sorry.
You okay?
No.
requires the corporation to assist, or the, gosh, and I've forgotten where I was.
Okay.
The corporation to assist people in both employers and individuals in qualifying for, thank you, Sandy, for medical assistance.
Lori, are you okay? We quit 10 minutes early. Is that a problem?
No, I'm fine. And my drugs are wearing off, I think.
Don't drive.
let's see. And L, paragraph L, beginning on 24, requires the corporation to provide employers with the names of employees who end coverage under a qualified health plan during the plan year. And what this is about is that once this goes into effect in 2014, employers must all of their employees must be enrolled in a qualified health plan. And if they're not, either not enrolled or the health plan that's being offered is not affordable or doesn't provide sufficient coverage, then the employers have a tax penalty. So this would assist employers in making sure they're not going to be subject to the tax penalty. In M, line 26, this section 5000A of the Internal Revenue Code is what's known as the individual mandate.
If
so,
I may, real quick, Mr. Chair,
please.
Because I didn't ask this question. I probably missed it on the Senate side. I tried to see as much as I could. How much is the penalty 7%? Of the payroll, or what's the penalty?
The employer penalty?
Yeah.
Representative Weiner, I'll have to get back to you on that. I don't have it off the top of my head.
And that's in the federal code, right?
Yeah.
Right.
That's correct, Representative Thompson.
When you get individual questions that you answer, will you answer the whole committee?
I will. Okay. Okay. And then line 29.
I'm well now.
Paragraph N. This is, again, the exchange. Their responsibility is to determine eligibility for individuals who apply for tax credits and reduce cost sharing. And people who get the tax credits are people who are otherwise uninsured through an employer. They're uninsured or they are insured, but their employer doesn't offer plans that are affordable or have the essential benefit package, and therefore they have to buy insurance on their own through the exchange. They get a tax credit. And for people who have incomes between 100 and 400% of the federal poverty line, there's also a program to it requires the insurers first to reduce the out-of-pocket maximums for the health insurance, and then the federal government reimburses the insurers for that reduced cost sharing.
All right, why don't you move to Section 4 now?
Okay.
The rest are mostly boilerplate, I think. Huh?
Okay. Section 4 is, which begins on page 6, is the Board of Directors, and it's composed of two ex officio members, which are the Director of the Oregon Health Authority and the Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, or the designee of each director. And then there are seven members who are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. One thing that's interesting about the way this one is structured is you'll see on lines 12 through 17 that the members do not serve completely at the pleasure of the governor, but they may only be removed for incompetence, neglect of duty, or malfeasance in office, and after notice in a hearing. And then we have two members. Let's see. All right. Then when you get to subsection 4 on 24, you have the additional requirements for the members who are not ex officio members. Have to be U.S. citizens, demonstrated professional community leadership skills, represent the geographic, ethnic, gender, racial, and ethnic diversity of the state, or economic diversity of the state. And then going on to page 7, top of page 7, collectively offer expertise, knowledge, and experience in individual health purchasing, finance, sales, health benefits administration, individual and small group health insurance, and the use of the health insurance exchange. And the point of saying the use of the health and insurance exchange is to make sure that there are consumers or purchasers through the exchange who are on the board. And then when you get into subsection 5 on line 6, oh, I'm sorry, subsection 6 on line 7, you have two members who have to be, you have to have at least two members that are consumer members, defined as someone who's an individual consumer purchasing through the plan or someone who's a small business employer.
We go back to 5. On the individual with an actual conflict of interest is defined in may not be appointed as a member of the board. I'm not sure that's a good idea.
Well, I think, Jim, this is one of the issues that we need to deal with, is the whole question.
Because I can see how that one provision is going to take out ever having an actuarial on that board, and we may find that to be very, very important.
Actually, it turns out not. I mean, when you look at the actual conflict of interest statute, that's a very narrow conflict of interest. I mean, it needs to be, they have a direct personal financial interest, specifically, not as a class. I mean, it's a
wouldn't a member of the board who buys insurance through the exchange have a direct financial conflict of interest?
That's what I said. I mean, but it's. I think we need to look at this whole section because there are real issues. Particularly, do you think the Dash Fives did a better job on the board membership?
Yeah, I mean, they went round and round, but the Dash Fives. It seems like every party that was involved came in, because I was about falling over with people coming in saying they were supporting it. I'm like, I mean, the only ones who didn't want it were the people who wanted a single payer system.
This seems
so. If you want single payer, you won't like the Dash Fives. If you want single payer, you're going to like.
I mean, in this issue particularly around, I think the Dash Five did a better job.
Yeah,
I mean,
the membership.
Because it brought somebody from every party involved. I mean, it was a pretty broad board.
Do you have that piece of the Dash 5s with you?
Yeah.
If it's not too difficult, we may do this on Monday. Could you compare, can you look at the board section and tell us what the differences are in the different iterations of the bill?
That'd be great.
And then we can take a look at all of that and say, you know, this is the combination we want to look at.
Is that where you want to start?
Well, I think we ought to look at.
I think it would be great.
I've gotten a number of emails on this section.
Yeah, this is an issue.
People either like it or hate it in the various amendments. And I think that's something we need to concentrate on. What is the nature of that board relative to what this committee wants, relative to what the Senate has done?
I think keeping Lori anymore is cruel and unusual punishment. We have two questions. Let's get those, and then we'll close them. We'll start with that when you take over on Monday.
Oh, no, sorry, Mr. Chair. I'll hold my question. It was more of a comment, so I'll hold it.
Was it Cannon?
My question.
Mr. Chairs, before you do that, and Representative Winder, I just want to point out that you can see sort of what the Dash 5s have. If you go on page 11
of this document,
subsection 4, there's a beginning, and then it goes on to page 12. There are limitations on who may be employed by the corporation and what. Yeah. The Senate Bill 99, the original -2-1, had this same limitation with respect to board members. Then it was taken out, and then in the -5 it was put back in again. So if you want to get an idea of what the -5s look like, you'll see it there. It's similar to the limits on the employees.
Great. Yes, ma'am.
Quick question.
Yes. Yeah. Should I try that again?
Well, are we going to acknowledge them that they're asking for specific days, or do you want a way to make that announcement?
We will have only invited testimony, but the invited testimony will come from people who have volunteered to be. I mean, some we want to ask, but others who want to testify. So, the same principles in place. Please get to the administrator and let her know that you want. We'll compile a list. President Thompson and I will work on it. Please don't ask for a specific day, because it will happen when it happens. And although we have a preference, that's fine. But the intention, again, is to manage not to deal with the individual wording. I don't want testimony. At least I don't. I think Jim doesn't either. On page 5, line 16, the word should be this and not that. I'm going to try and deal with these as issues. Board composition, power of the exchange to negotiate, all these kind of things. And we're asking Representative Cannon and Representative Kennemer to keep track of these things for us. And so we want the testimony to be specific to the general topics, but not an amendment suggestion for line 5 on page 14. Is that the way you think we should?
Yeah, and that was what I said earlier, or meant to say earlier. I think when we're doing this part, we've got to look at all of the iterations of this thing, and if there's a difference in dash 5 from the dash 2, put them side by side. You know, what's the...
See, if one or the other is what we want, or some combination?
Exactly. And I'm very interested in the difference. The Senate had some direction they were going in all of the amendments that they adopted, obviously. And that meant the amendments, I assume, meant changes or additions from the dash ones on through. I'm interested in what those changes were and why, and then how they are germane to this bill. One of them is board composition. I've heard a lot of discussion about that. I'm just expecting that all of the, although I was told the dash fives changed one word, but I'm suspecting that there were reasons for the dash amendments, because they must have changed something because somebody thought it was a good idea.
As you know, Jim, getting good policy is a combination of substance and politics.
Right.
And I think what was going on in the Senate is they had a political dynamic that was in the Senate. I think we have a slightly different political dynamic. So some of the changes were substantive changes, and some of the changes were political changes. And I think we need to have our own equation of how political.
Well, I know my caucus is not political. I'm not sure about yours.
I know. No, ours is very political.
Okay. Only one in the building.
The board and setting that up probably went on. It was, if you took all the time, it was probably 2 hours on just going back and forth and the makeup of the board and how it should be. Because you had the people, the consumers coming up saying only consumers should be on the board. Well, I'm a consumer. I would love to be just consumers on the board so we can say you're only going to charge this much. And it finally got to where we got a good makeup of doctors, insurers, consumers. I mean, and we were leaning that direction. So to make sure there was a well-balanced board there. But those are the things that become very political, too. And I think that's why we spent, well, not we, they spent 2 hours
on it.
I
think if we could do it in 2 hours, that would be just great. Yeah. I mean, if we could come to consensus among us on what that board ought to look like in 2 hours, that would be terrific. It's not a huge issue.
No.
I mean, it's obviously symbolic important, but I think the board will work pretty well, however you put it together.
Well, I think, I mean, with us here and invited testimony, it changes the dynamics dramatically, where we can come up with a good board, and we know that it needs to be balanced with everybody, so everybody has a voice and a say on that board.
Yep. The other side, though, if it's not a huge issue, then the easiest thing to do is adopt the Senate dash 5 position so we're consistent with what the Senate's doing. And if we don't do that, then it is a big issue because it's going to go somewhere for concurrence. And
True. The more concurrence we get, the easier it is.
Yeah. The more changes we adopt in our version, the more somebody's going to be in a conference committee sorting that out before it comes back to us in the Senate for concurrence. So, you know, if these things don't make a difference and we can do what the Senate did, that's going to move us forward faster with fewer difficulties, I think.
I think so, too.
Mr. Chair, following on your suggestion, would it help if I worked with Representative Kenemer and the co-chairs to identify in writing the 3 or 4 specific issues, such as composition of the board, that we would like to hear testimony and deliberate on? Because I think I agree with the thrust of this discussion. Probably the less that we try to alter a whole bunch of different pieces of this amendment, the better. And I'd be happy to try to identify what those
I understand what Representative Greenlick is doing. I guess I'm coming at the same thing from another direction. If we have a copy of what the Senate has approved, which we do not have, and we go through that and identify the changes we insist on making or not, ideally we'll go through the Senate version and that, hey, they got it right, then we're okay. That's unlikely. But we will make the relative, the fewest number of changes. Yes, the fewest number of changes. We can back things out of the Senate version if it's a wish of the committee not to go there. But if we identify the things we're backing out of the Senate bill or changing the Senate bill, might be easier than trying to build a bill separate from the Senate bill. I probably confused that issue.
I think we're talking about the same.
Okay.
It's just whether we build from a de novo. Well, it isn't de novo because it's their dash two. Whether we build up from the de novo or we build down from where they are. And I would include Lori in that group of you and Bill. Okay. I promise we'd be done at 5 on Friday. It's now 5 after. Close the work session on 3137 and adjourn for the week.
Yay.